You're listening to the For Our City podcast, a podcast devoted to helping you and your church make disciples of Jesus and advance His kingdom by serving the common good in your city. I'm Daryl Krauts, the host, and today's podcast is sponsored by Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Southeastern desires nothing more than to serve the church and fulfill the Great Commission. Located in the heart of Wake Forest, North Carolina, Southeastern offers 40 degrees from certificate to PhD, using multiple delivery formats. For more information or to apply, visit sebts.edu. Wherever you're going, Southeastern can help you get there. So my guest on the podcast today is Dr. Bruce Ashford, who actually serves as Provost and Professor of Theology and Culture at Southeastern. Bruce is a well-noted author, writing extensively on his own website, bruceashford.net, for national publications, and he has several books of his own. He's a sought-after thinker and speaker and writer who helps Christians live well in the public domains of life. Before we can effectively engage the culture or serve the common good in our own community, we must have a clear biblical framework of our own. Few people can help us do that better than Bruce Ashford. But let me encourage you to grab a pen and paper if you can. But either way, listen in to my recent conversation with Dr. Bruce Ashford as we considered the merits and then suggested maybe a few alternatives to Rod Dreher's most recent work, The Benedict Option.
So I'm here with Bruce Ashford. He is provost at Southeastern Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina. But Bruce, it's really good to have you.
Great to be on the show, Daryl. Thank you.
Well, you know, Abraham Kuyper has been a big influence in your life, and that's a lot of has really shaped a lot of your story. Can you tell us how that came about and how that really has shaped your not only your story but your ministry at this point?
Yes. So, you know, my formative years in Christianity were my parents and my churches growing up, and my parents especially did an incredible job teaching me the Bible, encouraging me to memorize scripture and so forth. The one thing that I had always in the back of my mind felt like I was lacking was a theological framework for understanding a Christian's life in the world. You know, what does it mean to seek the common good of the city when the Bible says that? What does it mean to bring different aspects of your life under the lordship of Christ? So I was living in Russia in my early 20s. I was, I think, 22 and 23 years old, in a predominantly Muslim area of Russia that was mostly Muslim but had a good number of atheists and a few Orthodox Christians. And I found myself really badly needing a theological framework for understanding Christianity and culture, and I happened upon Kuyper. And Kuyper, you know, was a Dutch prime minister more than 100 years ago, started out as a liberal pastor, went conservative, and then after that founded a university, nationwide newspaper, became a member of parliament, then became prime minister, and wrote 20-some books. Wow. So Kuyper's work's been very influential, not just his writings, but his life.
What about his life? He was obviously a busy guy. He obviously didn't keep to himself in terms of his theological convictions. He engaged in the public square. What did you see most about him that was inspiring?
You know, I think one is that he not only wrote about honoring the Lord in every sphere of culture, every sector of society, but then he went and he did it.
Yeah.
He ended up running for office. I think that's one thing. Then the second thing is he combined the strength of the Anabaptist tradition and the Calvinist Reformational tradition. The strength of the Anabaptist tradition is the local church being a colony of the kingdom, being a preview of God's coming kingdom, that the local church itself has a culture and a politic. Mm-hmm. And that culture and that politic is a witness to the world about the way the world's culture and politics should be. That's the strength of the Anabaptist movement. The strength of the Calvinist Reformational movement, our tradition, is that the local church disperses and sends its people out into the world to make the world better. So it's sowing this seed of the gospel into the soil of society and culture. And Kuyper tried to combine the best of both of those views.
That is so good and pretty applicable to where we are today, or where it seems like we should be today, in terms of our engagement. It seems sometimes we can be really theologically robust or feel like we are, but really disengaged, or the other way around. And so it seems like he brought both those two worlds together.
He did. I mean, you know, I think he had his flaws, but he has a lot that he can teach us right now in our moment in history. And we can't resent our moment in history, you know?
Absolutely.
This is the moment God's given us. We can't long for some purported golden age of the past.
Right.
You know, and so instead of sort of withdrawing on the one hand or charging into angry activism, mm-hmm. I think we can embrace the moment. And Kuiper can teach us how to embrace the moment.
Yeah, so good. I love that. Well, you wrote an article a few weeks ago called The Benedict Option versus the Abrahamic Option. And I read through that, I kind of wanted everybody that I know to read it. And because it resonated with where I am and what For Our City is all about. And so can you kind of walk us through that if folks haven't read it yet? Just kind of explain the premise and then some of the conclusions.
Yeah, sure. Maybe we can start. Let me start by sort of describing what Rod Dreher is responding to.
Yeah.
And then describe his response. And then after that, maybe give an assessment of it. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
So if I'm describing the lay of the land that to which Dreher is responding, I would actually draw upon a great American sociologist named Philip Reif, passed away about a decade ago, mm-hmm. I think maybe 2006, 2007. So toward the end of his career, Reif published a trilogy called the Sacred Order, Social Order Trilogy. And in it, he argued that historically, civilizations everywhere have understood that sacred order, as he puts it, or religion, religious order, undergirds and informs and shapes social order, as he puts it. So in mm-hmm. other words, religion shapes society. It shapes people and it shapes corporate society. And the trick is that religion uses cultural institutions and cultural products to shape society.
Sure.
And so sacred order shapes cultural institutions and products, which then in turn shapes people.
Mm-hmm.
And that religion provides basically a moral framework, what he calls a code of permissions and prohibitions. It provides meaning for life. It provides force behind the morals. In other words, there's someone enforcing morality, God himself.
Right.
Provides all these things. But right now, we're in the middle of a really odd time in history where people in the West and in the United States want to get rid of sacred order and leave social order sort of to float on its own.
Hmm.
And Reif said the consequences of this are going to be negative and even disastrous. That when you that first of all, social order will never float on its own.
Right.
So if you get rid of the Judeo-Christian framework, something else is going to fill the void and take its place. And in my words, I would say, listen, you don't like the religious right? Wait till you see the post-religious right.
Yeah.
That wasn't exactly how he put it, but mm-hmm. Secular progressivism and secular conservatism, divorced from a Judeo-Christian moral framework, and I think are going to be awful.
It's a disaster, right?
So that's what Dreher is responding to, is this process. And what he basically says is, listen, if we want to move forward in days like this, we ought to, you know, take our cues from Benedict of Nursia. So he was an early medieval monk mm-hmm. who retreated to the forest after Rome fell, and then eventually was involved in building monastic communities that were undergirded by order, hospitality, prayer, stability, mm-hmm. and things like this. So he's saying, listen, he's saying, here's what we need to do. We don't need to withdraw entirely from culture, but we need to take a lot of the energies, most of the energy that we would have spent on cultural engagement and political engagement, and just put that into local church communities. And we need to take a lot of the energy that we would have expended at the national political level and put it down at the local community and neighborhood level. And in that way, sort of follow Benedict's prescription.
Sure.
So yeah, that's a little bit of a description. Let me see if I can read. I don't think I have a quote handy with me, but he's got some really, you know, here's one.
Yeah.
Let me read one. He says, Here's how to, this is where he talks about politics in particular, and he calls it anti-political politics. He says, here's how you get started with the anti-political politics of the Benedict option. Secede culturally from the mainstream. Turn off the television, put the smartphones away, read books, play games, make music, feast with your neighbors. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to avoid what is bad. You must also embrace what is good. So start a church or start a group within your church. Open a classical Christian school or join and strengthen one that exists. Plant a garden. Participate in a local farmer's market. Teach kids how to play music. Start a band. Join the volunteer fire department. So that gives you a little bit of a picture of what he's trying to do. Now, he treats a lot more than just the political arena. He treats education, politics, art, and different sectors of society. But I focused in a little bit on politics in my critique.
Sure. And so his is a more of a local, a retreat from this great idea of a movement in order to preserve what's good?
Yes. He's saying, you know, the onslaught, he's saying, listen, we look at all the political engagement we've done, if you want to call it that, political activism. Mm-hmm. And what have we got for it? Not much of anything, just kind of crushed ice and vapor.
Yeah.
So he said, listen, it's not working for us. We need to sort of double down. To use a workout analogy, I don't think he used that, but the workout analogy would build your core muscles.
Yeah, right.
You know, before you go out to war. Yeah. And he's wanting us to spend a lot more time, most of our time, building the local church and building local initiatives and less time out there engaging the world.
Yeah. And you offered you didn't dismiss that completely out of hand, and we're not throwing all of that out as we have this discussion, but you did suggest a different kind of pathway. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, playfully I call it the Abrahamic alternative,
yeah.
you know,
That's
after
awesome.
Abraham Kuyper.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I do want to say, I think with Rod's proposal and with mine, there's a difference in emphasis.
Yeah.
And that's what I've got is a difference in emphasis. Let me say some positive things about his book first.
Sure.
I think it's very pastoral in nature. He cares about the church. He cares about God's people.
Absolutely.
I think he's got a discerning eye to see different corruptions in society and culture and politics. I think he's got a good amount of humility in the way he writes. So just, and there are other things in that. I just want to mention he's a good guy and he cares about the church.
Absolutely.
In terms of emphasis, you know, so I'll get to the emphasis. I've got two main critiques. Let me start with creation's normative order. One thing that Rod does not stress in his book that Kuyper stresses and that I appreciate is that God ordered the world normatively. And what we mean by that is he gave it a particular ordering and for a particular reason.
Mm-hmm.
And just like God created different kinds of animals and even different genders of human beings, he actually created different kinds of culture. So he created the world to be the type of world that would have a sphere of culture that we call education, one that we call arts,
sure,
science, politics, family, church, and so forth. And as Kuyper put it, each of these spheres is God created for its own unique purpose. It has its own center, if you will, its own reason for existence.
Mm-hmm.
It also has its own circumference. So if we were just to take politics for a moment, politics has its own center, reason for being, and that is to achieve justice for the different individuals and communities under its purview. It also has a circumference. And it's supposed to achieve justice for the communities under its purview. It's not supposed to control the arts or tell families what to do and not to do.
Right.
Or tell the churches what to do or not to do. Same thing for the church. Church has a reason for existence and it has limits. Church isn't supposed to control the government. You know, Southern Baptist Convention is not supposed to function in the place of Congress.
Right. That's good. That's a good word. Yeah.
And so what we do in each of these spheres of culture is we enter into it. I think, you know, Kuyper said, and we ask three questions. What is God's creational design for this sphere? Number two, has it been corrupted by sin and idolatry? Number three, how can we bring healing and redirection to the corruption and misdirection? And that's where I don't think we have the choice to withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would emphasize, even though Rod didn't say fully to withdraw, he was, you know, he's saying mostly withdraw. And I want to say, no, let's Rod, you're right. Let's strengthen the church, absolutely, and at the same time, let's strengthen our engagement, our interaction, our interface with the world.
Right.
So that's creation's normative order. And the neat thing about these spheres is they form a sort of system of checks and balances, not government checks and balances like the legislative, judicial, and executive branch, or the federal versus the state level of authority. These are checks and balances at the ontological level built into creation, that you have all of these different spheres that each have their own integrity and own purpose. So no one sphere controls all the others. God doesn't intend for them to.
Right.
And that's the beauty of his creation.
That's so good and really helpful, I think, as we think about our role in God's work, in God's kingdom work here in our own communities. Jeremiah 29 is one of the bases for what For Our City is all about. Obviously, the language comes from Jeremiah 29 as Jeremiah is writing back to these exiles in Babylon, and he says, I want you to plant your life there. You're not leaving anytime soon. He said, I want you to pursue peace or the welfare, the wholeness of your city, and then pray for your city. And I think those, and then obviously as Jesus served and carried out his ministry, he was very much engaged at where people lived in whatever sphere they were in. Can you talk about how this affects just the decision making of the everyday Christian who is wanting to seek the common good in their neighborhood or in their sphere of influence?
Yeah, let me do that. Can I weave that into my second critique of the Benedict option?
Absolutely, sure.
Yeah, so the first critique was creation's normative order. The second, not critique, but interaction God, is the church's division of labor.
Yeah.
And, as Kuyper put it, the church is both an institution and an organism. Mm-hmm. And it's an institution that gathers weekly to worship the Lord. And practically speaking, to get to your question, one of the best ways the people of God can engage the world is by being meaningful members of their local church, gathering every week to declare together that Jesus is Lord and Caesar is not. Jesus is Lord and Congress is not. Jesus is Lord and the president is not. Sex and money and power are not. And so we gather when we take the Lord's Supper, when we listen to the word preached, when we sing, and we strengthen our core muscles, if you will, spiritually, around the fact that Jesus is Lord.
Absolutely. And
that's a powerful witness. And that's what Rod is emphasizing. But I think also the church is an organism connected to Christ at the head. And even when we scatter for the rest of the week, we're still connected to Christ and to each other. And practically for just an everyday American Christian who is a meaningful member of their church, they need to realize that Sunday morning worship is meant to prepare us for Monday morning public life. And for us to embrace all of the aspects of culture, that we experience, and to try to ask those three questions that Kuyper asked. What would God's design be for this aspect of culture? Mm-hmm. How's it been corrupted by sin? And how can we bring healing to it through the gospel and through conforming it to God's word? If you want, I could spend a couple of minutes applying it to our current era in the United States.
Absolutely. I think that's where we live, that we're really not sure beyond yelling at each other on social media or just retreating and saying, I'll let somebody else handle that. I don't know that we know exactly what our next step is.
Yeah. I think the last couple years in American public life have been like a combination of a war, a carnival, and a Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
It's just been one after another. It's like every week is another opportunity for idiocy, inanity, ugliness, demeaning and degrading speech. Yeah. There's also a sense as evangelicals, as Bible-believing Christians, that we're being decentered.
Yeah.
Marginalized a little bit, not nearly as bad as churches, places where the church is persecuted and underground, but nonetheless, in a real way, we're being moved away from the center, and that's okay. We need to embrace the moment, and I'm going to give four categories.
So
in our public life, we need to find an appropriate way to recenter God in public discourse. Now, there's all kinds of inappropriate ways to recenter God. By tying God into public policy decisions and acting like God, you know, declared to be on your side in a public policy dispute, mm-hmm. when in fact the Bible is not clear about it at all, you know, I think that's unhelpful.
Right.
It's unhelpful to call ourselves a Christian and then engage in public life in an ugly and degrading way, you know, with our speech and so forth. So how do we recenter God in a public way? I think one way is to find ways of stressing that the Bible's narrative is the true story of the whole world, that the CNN narrative is actually not the true story of the whole world. The Washington Post narrative, the Fox News narrative, the Sean Hannity narrative, those are not the true stories of the whole world. The Bible's narrative is. And when we're doing that, we're also going to be able to show that Jesus is Lord, and none of the world's other false lords are actually Lord. Anything in the world, any good thing in the world can be made into a god. In fact, the only things that can be made into false gods are good things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things that God created.
Right.
Sex or money or power or liberty or, you know, wealth or whatever it is we're going to raise to some ultimate level. We need to show that Jesus is Lord and that these other things are counterfeit gods and false saviors and terrible lords.
Yeah.
The second thing we need to do is to decenter the self. And this is, I think, the point of your podcast from what I've heard, mm-hmm. is if we're decentering ourselves, this gives us room to do a couple of things. If it's not all about us and us getting a victory right now in the moment and winning every debate that we have, you know, on a national stage, then we get to seek the good of the city instead of just the good of our own tribe or right. just our own personal good.
Absolutely.
We get to be the heart and strength of every good movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then another way of decentering the self is to care not only about the truth content of what we say in public, but the disposition and demeanor we have and the tone we have when we say those things. All of us, myself included, have got to learn how to say things in a way that ascribe respect to the other person,
mm-hmm.
love, genuine Christian love, so forth.
Right.
Third thing we need to do is to reframe issues. If the Bible's narrative is the true story of the whole world, then the way we treat issues is going to differ often from the way, a secular conservative or secular progressive would frame an issue. And it's hard work to figure that out sometimes, but we need to figure it out.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
and
good.
Then finally, we need to revitalize culture. And that is to get in and try to renew cultural institutions and products, to get in and renew the business world and the legal world, the art world, the science world, the education world, family. And when we do that, we are taking the broad view and playing the long game.
Yeah.
What I mean by playing the long game is we refuse to put all of our eggs in the basket of short-term political activism, because when we do that, we're often going to sacrifice our witness on the altar of an election victory or a debate, scoring a point in a public debate. And what we want to do is play the long game, Christian witness over the long haul, over the course of two generations.
Right.
And
yeah.
Then,
I just have a question there. I know there's two more categories here, but building the institutions seems to be so important for the long game, as you say, but seems to be not a priority of this generation or the one behind me that's coming up. Can you talk about that a little bit and how we can help folks, help maybe millennials and Gen Zers and so on, understand how important that is and how they can affect change over time?
Yeah, so you need movements and institutions. Hmm. Historically, evangelicals have been good at movements. Mainstream denominations have been better at building big institutions and long-lasting institutions.
Yeah.
You know, this generation wants movement but doesn't care about institutions. It doesn't trust institutions.
Right.
Institutions are very important because institutions shape people. Movements dissipate without institutions. They dissipate and dissolve and leave very little of effect.
Right.
Now, family is an institution, mm-hmm. and church is an institution, but there are other institutions that matter. legal institutions, businesses, schools and universities. And so if we can strengthen them, and this brings us back to our last category still, the revitalizing culture one, we're not just playing the long game or taking the broad view, that if we can enter into all of these spheres of culture, if we can begin renewing these different institutions, that our combined witness from these many different platforms, if you will, the combined witness is so much more powerful than if we're just, you know, like the special interest arm of one of the major political parties.
Right. That's so good. And it seems to affect people at the most basic levels. Sometimes the flash in the pan movements seem to inspire for a time, but it doesn't really fundamentally transform a community or a family for that matter.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, I want to go back and say, too, I wonder if you agree with me. I said a minute ago that this particular generation doesn't care about institutions, but, you know, usually young people at any time in history care a lot less about institutions.
Right.
Because they're able to see the flaws in institutions. But I think often the young people then tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater and just say, hey, let's get rid of the institutions. They don't realize that it takes millions and millions of dollars and lots of blood, sweat, and tears to build those institutions that are so important.
Yeah, I think you're onto something. And I think one of the things that seems to be, well, increasingly apparent is we're very impatient. And so we want our life to count. And that's the terminology. And what that means is we have to have results now. I know folks in my church, we're drinking from wells we didn't dig. Somebody else invested in this church family, for example, so that my kids can have a great opportunity. Their kids probably didn't have the same opportunity as my kids do because of the sacrifices they made. So I think a lot of times we want our life to count, but what we mean is we want our life to count right now and see the results right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's an article for you to write there.
I'll work on that.
On it being a virtue of being willing to be patient over the long haul.
Yeah, it's really good. Well, you've got some other categories here. Did we cover?
Well, no. Let me review them really quickly, and then I did have a kind of a concluding comment.
Yeah.
So we want to recenter God, decenter the self. Those two have to come together because if we have the self at the center, then God can't be at the center. Sure. So recenter the self, recenter God, decenter the self, reframe issues, and then revitalize culture.
Sure. Perfect. Yeah.
There's a quote, Richard John Neuhaus, who founded the Institute on Religion and Public Life, was the founder and editor-in-chief of First Things magazine for years, said at some point, I forget if he wrote it or said it, that when he meets the Lord one day, he will meet him as a Christian and as an American. And I think that's true, that if we're born here in the United States, we will meet him one day as an American. And we won't meet him primarily as an American, we'll meet him primarily as his child, as a Christian, but we will meet him as an American. That's a necessary and significant part of our identity. And the question is, how will we give account of the fact that he placed us in this context right now and asked us to embrace it as missionaries, basically? And so I think the challenge for our church, if I can put it, to steal a phrase from Leslie Newbegin, if you find a man named Leslie, learn everything you can from him. because that man probably had a tough childhood. But he wanted to talk. He always talked about bringing the West into a missionary encounter with the gospel. And that's what we've got to do, is to bring our nation into a missionary encounter with the gospel. Missionaries don't go into another culture and berate it without listening. They don't mock it. They're not condescending. They listen attentively to the people to whom they want to minister, and then they try to bring the gospel into a powerful interface with the people to whom they want to minister.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we've got to find out how to do in the United States, and that missionary encounter will come not only through church, but through education and art and science and even politics.
Absolutely.
And that's our challenge. How can we bring our nation into a missionary encounter with the gospel?
That is so good. And we'll leave it there. My guest has been Bruce Ashford. He's the professor of theology and culture and provost at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's written a number of books, two of which is Every Square Inch, An Introduction to Cultural Engagement for Christians, and then One Nation Under God, A Christian Hope for American Politics. I would encourage you to pick those up. They'll be available in the show notes as well. And then check out BruceAshford.net. Great resources there, great articles to help you and me build have a theological framework for cultural engagement and really living in a way that is for the good of our city. So, Bruce, thank you so much for being with us today.
Daryl, it's been great. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Well, if you're like me, this is a podcast you may want to listen to again. Bruce packed in some great information and insights that every thoughtful and helpful Christian will want to apply. So let me encourage you to do three things. Number one, check out today's show notes at forourcity.us. I'll have links to Bruce's website, which by the way needs to be a favorite on your browser, to his latest books, and to his social media handles. You'll really want to follow him. Bruce is a valuable resource as he speaks and writes with both theological depth and practical wisdom. Number two, I'd love for you to offer your own feedback on today's podcast in the comments section at forourcity.us. I'd love to hear from you and just your impressions of today's interview. And then number three, please subscribe and share the For Our City podcast with your friends. I promise to provide a steady diet of gospel-rich and practically valuable content each week that will help you make an impact in your city. So thank you for listening in. Thank you for your partnership as we learn together to live for our city.